Well, Matthew 24, of course, Matthew 23 sort of sets the stage for Matthew 24. Jesus has, in Matthew 23, has castigated the Pharisees because of the things that they had done. He pronounced a sentence upon the Pharisees and upon those in Jerusalem who just blindly followed them wherever they went, because they had followed them to their own destruction. Then he comes to Jerusalem. Apparently he's walking with his disciples. He comes to Jerusalem and he makes an amazing statement, Matthew 24, verses 1-3. That statement is also recorded for us, and the questions that the apostles asked in Mark, the 13th chapter, and about verse 4, in Luke, the 21st chapter, and along about verse 7, and then it's here in Matthew 24, verses 1-3. I think Jesus is talking about what he's been talking about, the destruction of Jerusalem, the judgment on Jerusalem. And I think the apostles asked him a question about when that was going to happen. If you look at it in Matthew 24, the apostles said, "What shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world?" If you look at it in Luke 21, the apostles simply say, "What shall be the sign when these things are about to come to pass?" Mark, the 13th chapter, verse 4, "What shall be the sign when these things are all to be accomplished?" It seems to me that some of the confusion has arisen because the different wording of the apostles' question here in Matthew 24. I'm not ready to dismiss Matthew 24 in favor of the other two accounts, but we just have to acknowledge that there are three accounts of this interchange between the apostles and Jesus. Matthew's account is much broader than the account in Mark and Luke. Jesus does say that some of the people in that generation would not pass away until these things had happened. He says, this is the end of the world. This is the end of the age. In Hebrews, the 9th chapter, verse 26, you see the same kind of phraseology that you see here in Matthew 24. And he's talking about Jesus suffering. He says, if Jesus' suffering had not been complete, if Jesus' suffering had not been once for all, then he must have suffered often since the foundation of the world, but now once at the end of the ages. So it's the end, in my mind, of a period of time, the end of a system of God dealing with men. Now, there have been other times when God's method of dealing with men changed. There have been radical shifts. One of those radical shifts occurred at the flood. One of the radical shifts occurred when God took Moses up on the mountain, gave him the Ten Commandments and the law, and he came down and the people said, "We will follow God." Now, in that case, it was not a generalized shift. I think God continued to deal with the rest of the world the way he'd always dealt with the rest of the world up to that time. But he singled out one family, and we'll talk about that in terms of predestination on Sunday. But when he says it's the end of the age, if you were vested in the way things used to be, as far as you're concerned, that's the end of the world. That's the end. That's the end of everything you know. Think about it from the Jewish perspective. Everything they knew was tied up in the theocracy. You had the king, you had the priests, you had certain sacrifices that you made on certain days, and here comes Jesus and he says, that's all gone. That doesn't matter anymore. That's done away with. But he says, I didn't come to destroy the law, I came to fulfill it. He says, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. So not only is it the end of the world, as far as you're concerned, it's the destruction of heaven and earth. This was an idiom as far as the Jews were concerned. Heaven and earth was everything that there was. So when you see Jesus using this term, the end of the age, he really is, as far as the Jews are concerned, talking about the end of everything that they had relied on to have a relationship with God. So the apostles said, when is this going to happen? And that's what Jesus turns his attention to. I think that's the question that Jesus is answering for the apostles in Matthew, the 24th chapter. And he gives them a number of different signs to look for. Some of the signs that Jesus mentioned are going to be interpreted the wrong way. Some people will look at the signs and they'll say, oh, it's now. That's not the sign. So let's go through Matthew, the 24th chapter. And let's kind of look at these signs that Jesus mentioned. As I was thinking about this again, I think I should have included verses 4 and 5 as one of the signs. And this is why I say sometimes there were signs that Jesus talked about, or things that would happen that people would say, oh, this is a sign. And Jesus says, no, this is not the sign yet. This is not the sign you think it is. But let's go through this. Matthew 24, verses 4 and 5, and I didn't give you this. Jesus said to them, take heed that no man lead you astray. Many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ. And they'll lead many away. So this is one of those things. Jesus says, you're going to see people coming and they're going to say, I am the Messiah. I am the Christ. And a lot of people will be caught up in that. And Josephus talks about that period after Jesus was here until Jerusalem is destroyed in AD 70. And he says that the land of Judah, in his words, was overrun with magicians and seducers and imposters. This is from his Jewish Wars, volume 6. He says, they draw people after them in multitudes into solitudes and deserts to see the signs and miracles that they promised to show by the power of God. It was all a lie. It was all a big scam. But a lot of people got taken in by it. And these were people who had perhaps, I don't know this for certain, but these were people who had perhaps even been exposed to what Jesus had said. And you would think if you had seen Jesus raise Lazarus from the dead, and remember, that's the miracle that got him into so much trouble with the Pharisees. They eventually, the Sanhedrin, after John the 11th chapter, said, we're going to have to kill him. Because if we don't, he's going to take down the nation. Raising Lazarus from the dead, I mean, that, you just can't fake that. He's been dead for 4 days. The people that were there said, don't roll away the stone, he's going to stink. The process of biodegradation has already begun. And how could you get caught in a scam if you know what a real miracle looks like? Now, I want to stop here for just a minute and say, I understand how that happens. I was watching a television evangelist when I lived in Southern California. I was a lot younger then. And he had people come up on the stage and they said that they were deaf. And he would shout in their face, can you hear me? And no response. And then he put his finger in their ears and he popped his finger out. And these people said, all of a sudden, I can hear. And I happened to be watching that with some people that were deaf. Now, my response was, wow, he did something to cure their deafness. I was convinced it was a miracle that somehow he'd done something. But the people that I was watching it with, they said, no, you get sucked into that because you don't know what a deaf person looks like. They weren't taken in by that. They said, those people, if they were deaf before, they're still deaf. But it's easy when you don't know what deafness looks like to think that somebody cured deafness just because somebody says they did. But Mona and Greg, and that was my stepmom's daughter and her son, or her husband, who were watching that with me, they said, no, you just got taken in by that. So people get taken in by these phony miracles. And Jesus says, a lot of people are going to be led astray. That's not it. Okay. What did somebody see as the sign in verse 6? Anybody?
There's some rumors of wars.
Okay. Wars and rumors of wars. But again, look at what Jesus says. Don't be troubled. These things must needs come to pass, but the end is not yet. Nations will rise up against nations. Kingdoms will rise up against kingdoms. And you might say that there's also a sign here, famines and earthquakes in divers places, but all these things are the beginning of travail. That it's not this. And if you look at the history of the Roman Empire, Josephus, in his Jewish Wars in volume 4, he said, it's chapter 9 at verse 2, he says it this way: the history of Rome records the most violent agitations previous to the destruction of Jerusalem. Four emperors, Nero, Galba, Otho, and Vitellius, suffered violent deaths. They were all killed by their courtiers in just the short space of 18 months. So there's assassination. It's looking really bad. He also said that Bardanes, B-A-R-D-A-N-E-S, I think it's Bardanes, and after him, Vologenes, declared war against the Jews, but it wasn't executed. For one reason or another, they declared war, and then nothing came of it. Vitellius, who was the governor of Syria, declared war against Artes, the king of Arabia, wanted to lead his army through Palestine, but Tiberius died and stopped that war. It didn't happen. So there's wars, actual wars. There's rumors of wars. That's not it. Not yet. Verse 9 and 10 together. Who had the signs that you see in verses 9 and 10?
The early Christians.
Okay. Is it directed to the early Christians, or do you think that this might be directed even to the Jewish leadership, as well as the early Christians? Now, the early Christians meet this part of that sign that says you'll be hated by all of you'll be hated of all nations for my name's sake. But it wasn't just the early Christians that were being persecuted. It was the Jews as well. In fact, during that period of time, a lot of the foreign nations, Rome in particular, didn't view the Christians as a separate group. They viewed the Christians as a part of Judaism. The Jews didn't view Christians that way. The Jews hated the Christians. The Romans just hated everybody that lived in Judea. And they lumped them all together, Jews and Christians alike. So that the Christians absolutely are being persecuted, but the Jews are being persecuted as well. And I think this is not unlike the promises that Jesus has been making all along. They hated me, they're going to hate you. That started really mostly with the Jews, but it was picked up by the Romans. Even after the Romans completely destroyed the Jews, the Christians continued to be persecuted. Let's see. Verse 11.
False prophets will arise and will mislead many.
Okay. Again, this is Josephus. This is in his complete works in volume 6. He says, there was then a great number of false prophets suborned by the tyrants to impose upon the people who denounced this to them that they should, or who announced this to them, excuse me, that they should wait for deliverance from God. This was in order to keep them from deserting, that they might be buoyed up above the fear and care by such hopes. So once the siege of Jerusalem actually begins, there were false prophets. Just this has happened before in history. Not just when the Romans came, but you remember from our study of Jeremiah, how the people, the false prophets were saying, trust in God, he'll deliver us. So these false prophets really begin to arise. And many of those false prophets were bought and paid for by various factions of the Jewish leadership, because they're trying to keep their people from deserting. They didn't have much influence over the Christians, but they did have a lot of influence over the Jews. Let's see, verse 14.
The gospel will be preached in the whole world, then the end will come.
Okay. I think this is really important. The gospel will preach to the whole world. Where did the gospel begin to be preached?
Jerusalem.
Jerusalem. And then what was it spread? Jerusalem?
Judea.
Okay.
Samaria and to the uttermost parts of the world.
Okay. So by the time that the apostles were alive and had done a great deal of their work, Romans, the first chapter, verse 8, Paul said, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for you all, that your faith is proclaimed throughout the whole world. 1 Corinthians 1, verse 5 and 6 and verse 23, the truth of the gospel which has come unto you, as it is also in all the world, bearing fruit and increasing. He finally says, don't be moved away from the hope of the gospel that you heard, which was preached in all creation under heaven. That's in Colossians, the first chapter. And Colossians, to the best we can determine, was written in the year 62. Maybe 61, 63. But most people would say Colossians was written in 62. What was it that caused the gospel to go out so quickly?
Persecution.
Exactly. Exactly. And I always try to point out, anytime I talk about that persecution, that the people that spread the gospel were the ordinary Christians, just regular folks, because the apostles, the people that you would think, oh, that's the people that have to go and teach the rest of the world, the apostles stayed in Jerusalem. Read the first part of the book of Acts. It's amazing how that happened. And I was just spending some time, again, this is a bit of an aside, I was spending some time reading today some research that was done by the Barna Association. And they said that today, when they contact Christians, and remember that Barna does research across the broad spectrum of Christianity, Barna said that only 2 in 5 Christians that they talk to have ever talked to anybody else about their faith. We're not doing what the early Christians did. And Barna, I've ordered a book because I'm really interested in doing some more reading about this. Barna has concluded, based on their interviews, that much of the time, because the society that we're a part of has said that Christianity is a private matter, much of the time, we're content to keep it a private matter. We don't talk to other people about it. Sometimes that's because, you know, you're in a workplace, and if you say anything about Christianity, then you're going to get a nasty gram from the folks over at HR, and they're going to tell you, you can't talk about Christian, you can't talk about religion in the workplace. You just can't do that. Somebody's going to get offended. And so we kind of pull back, and we don't talk to other people about Christianity. Sometimes, you know, you own your own business, and you're a little reluctant to say anything about what you believe because not everybody shares your belief, and you don't want to alienate customers. That's no different than saying, if you're going to work for me, you can't have tattoos that show, because it would alienate people. Kim dealt with that at the city of Pomona. If you're going to be a policeman, you can't have tattoos that show. You can have a tattoo if you want to, but you can't let it show. If you have a tattoo on your arm and it's 96 degrees outside, you're going to wear a long sleeve shirt. And I've been in those positions. When I was working for the state, I had private conversations with people about Christianity, but when other people could hear those discussions, I didn't talk about it. That's just one of those things that we have to deal with. So the gospel, because these people went out and talked about their faith, it had gone to the entire world. You put the gospel in some place like Corinth, that's basically a seaport, and you start converting these people that are traveling the world, it's going to spread pretty quickly. It's just like, you know, in some ways, it's like coronavirus. If the thing broke out in China, it didn't take it very long to get around the world. We do it because people fly on airplanes. They did it because people moved around the world. They moved slower than we do, but they still moved around the world. So the gospel is preached into all the world. Then the end comes. It's not going to happen until I make sure that the gospel is preached in the entire world. I have not yet, in my way of thinking, I have not yet figured out the importance of the gospel being preached to the Gentiles prior to the judgment on Jerusalem and the Jews. I don't know what that link was. I can't I can't conceptualize of the link, but I can say that it happened. And I guess if I get to heaven and I get to talk to Jesus, I'm going to ask him about that. Why did the gospel have to be preached to the Gentiles? Because it was the end of an age for the Gentile world as well. Remember, the Gentiles come into Christianity at about 45, the year 45. That's about when Cornelius is converted. So about 10 years after the beginning of the gospel, it reached to the Gentiles, and then it spread more quickly among the Gentiles than it did among the Jews. But by the year 62, the Apostle Paul could convincingly say that the gospel has been preached in all creation under heaven. And it doesn't surprise me at all that it happened that quickly.
Dean?
Yeah.
This throughout the whole world, that's the known world to them. That's not Fiji and Australia and New Zealand and South America. It's their known world, not the whole world as far as we know it.
Well, perhaps. If perhaps. But I see no reason that it couldn't have been preached in China or Fiji just as easily as in the known world as they knew it. We have a tendency to think, well, people didn't travel. People didn't circumnavigate the globe. But you don't have to circumnavigate the globe. One person doesn't have to go all the way around the world. All I have to do is talk to somebody that's farther east than I am. And Carol raises a good point. I think that his primary reference was to the world that was then known. But if there were people in Fiji or people in the Philippines or people in Australia, I'm not going to say that the gospel hadn't reached those shores.
Lee says that Oikoumene meant the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire referred to the land that Rome had control.
Yeah, that's largely true. That was generally speaking the way that they used it. Yes. But they clearly knew that there were people on the outside edges of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire, by the year 70, has been having to fight wars in Britain, in the East. They're fighting wars in Africa. So they clearly knew that there were people outside the bounds of the Roman Empire. But I think in many ways, that was probably the primary emphasis. And the Roman Empire, of course, included the Jews and the Gentiles. Okay, let's see. Now we get to some a little bit more specific ones. Verse 15. What sign do you see there in verse 15? I lost you. Was that Lee?
The abomination of desolation.
Okay. And what do you think? What do you think that was?
Was that the of the temple, the abomination where they put the pigs in the temple?
That's one of the things that they did. Yes, they sacrificed a pig on the altar in the temple. And of course, the pig is an unclean animal. Once they brought the pig into the temple is unclean. And so it was one of the worst abominations. They hung the Roman ensign in the temple. The Roman, well, it wasn't necessarily a flag. It was an eagle, kind of a flagpole kind of thing. But they did that. They took down the Jewish temple accoutrements. They raised the pagan symbols. They raised the Roman standards. Once that happens, know that this is the end. This one, unlike some of the others, where he says people get sucked into scams, that's not it. I think this is the important one where he sort of shifts. And this one you're not going to miss. And they all knew what this was. That was something that they had learned from children. It was what Daniel said. Josephus talks about all of the things that they did in the Jewish Wars, Volume 6. And it's Chapter 6, Verse 1. It's where he starts to talk about this. It was an amazing... The Romans so hated the Jews that they wanted to make their temple useless. I don't think the Romans really wanted to burn down the temple. The Jews started the fires. At least that's what Josephus says. And that might be a prejudiced view, but I do know that there was so much infighting among the Jews. The Jews started fires in their own city, burned it. The Romans were no friend of the Jews. They hated the Jews, but I'm not sure they wanted to tear down the temple. Once the city caught on fire, the Romans sort of took advantage of it, but it was a combination of the Roman destruction and the Jewish destruction. I think I also should have included verses 17 through about verse 20 as a sign here. It's not so much a sign as it is Jesus says, when you see the abomination of desolation, he says, let him that is on the housetop not go down to take out the things that are in his house. If you see it, it's like when your house catches fire, run outside, run away. Don't go back to get the family heirlooms. Let him that is in the field not return back to take his cloak. Woe to them that are with child and those that give suck in those days. Pray that your flight be not in the winter, neither on a Sabbath. I had a discussion with a Sabbatarian, a person that worshiped on the Sabbath. And he said, see right there, Jesus says the Sabbath day is still holy. And I thought, well, maybe I have misunderstood all of this. There's a couple of things to understand about this. He says, pray that your flight be not on the Sabbath. Why? not necessarily because it was holy, but because the gates were locked. So if he's saying, when you see the abomination of desolation, run for the hills and pray that it's not on the Sabbath. When the Maccabees fought against the Romans, the Maccabees refused to fight on the Sabbath day. They refused to leave their tents. And the Romans walked through the camp and it was wholesale slaughter. That's not what he's talking about. What he's talking about is pray that you don't have to run on the Sabbath day because the gates are locked. The city's locked down. You can't get out of the city. That's just like pray that you don't do it when you're pregnant because it's hard to run for your life when you're pregnant. It's hard to run for your life when you have a baby. It's hard to run for your life when it's in the winter. And they do have winter in Jerusalem. I just saw a thing, saw a news feed that it was snowing in Jerusalem. So, you know, I tend to forget that.
Steve?
Yeah.
Well, it's not just that the gates to the Jerusalem would be shut. Their habit of how far they could travel on the Sabbath.
Oh, that's true.
I mean, that's that they couldn't run very far because of the same reason the Maccabees got slaughtered.
Yeah, Sabbath day's journey. That would have the Sabbath day's journey idea would have a serious impact for the Jews. The Christians would have rejected that idea. They would have said, well, there is no Sabbath day's journey requirement anymore. The old laws passed away. But the Jews certainly would have been impacted by it. And the Christians would have been impacted by the fact that the gates were locked. Now, that was a part of the Old Testament provisions. But since the Christians were in a position where they didn't control who put the padlock on the gates, or that's figurative, if they lock the gates, you're stuck. And we know what happened was when all of this started, most of the Christians in Jerusalem, not all, but most of the Christians in Jerusalem headed for the hills and they established a church in the hill town of Pella. And that church existed up into the 3rd century. It was Christians that ran away from Jerusalem. So it was, I don't think it was because it was a holy day, and I wasn't very bright back then. I might not be bright even today, but at least this one's not going to get me. Verse 21.
For then there will be a great tribulation such as has not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever will.
Okay. He says it's a bad time.
Yeah.
And that's putting it lightly. This is what Josephus says about what happened when the Jews or when the Romans laid siege to Jerusalem. In the Jewish Wars, in the preface, he says, it appears to me that all the misfortunes of men from the beginning of the world, if they be compared to those of the Jews, are not so considerable. He said, during the worst part of the siege, when no grain was left, wholesale destruction took place within the walls of Jerusalem. Food was so scarce, according to Josephus, that any locked door meant that someone had food inside. And this is what the Jews did inside of the city. This is not what the Romans did to it. This is what the Jews did to themselves. Marauders would break down the doors, rush in, and grab the throats of those inside, hoping to squeeze a morsel of food from their throats. Whole families died during the siege. Tomb robbing was rampant. Josephus said that he saw 600,000 bodies thrown out of the gates of the city. And there may have been as many as 8 million people in the city of Jerusalem. Romans caught one deserter with gold that he had swallowed trying to get out of the city. They suspected that many Jews were doing that. In the night, he says the Romans killed 2,000 Jews and ripped open their stomachs in case they had swallowed gold. Josephus tells a story of one mother who was so hungry, she roasted her infant son, ate half of him, and offered the other half to her neighbor. This is what war was like back then. And this war was one of the worst. Now, the siege began. Vespasian was the general who was leading the army against Jerusalem. And then after he started the siege, there was tumult back in Rome. So he had to run back to Rome to become the emperor. And then, after a short period, they broke off the siege. So he took his army to go back to Rome. After a short period, he sent his son Titus back to Jerusalem to finish the siege. And during that break, that's when the Christians ran. That's when the Jews were doing everything they could, telling people, don't run, don't run. See, God is for us. God is blessing us. They've broken off the siege. We're okay. And then when Titus came back, it was truly horrible. I can't imagine dealing with that kind of well, he calls it the Great Tribulation. And I have even watched the stories of the Polish ghettos. It never descended to this point, even inside the worst of the ghettos. And that, of course, was during World War II. Verse
24. It says false Christ and false prophets will arise and will show great signs and wonders so as to mislead.
Yeah, even the elect, even the Christians. This is a repeat of what we've already talked about. Verse 27 and 28, he says, as the lightning cometh from the east and is seen even to the west, so shall be the coming of the Son of Man. Remember, we've said that this is judgment. This is what this phrase, coming of the Son of Man, talks about. In this case, it was Jesus leading leading, Jesus sending at his behest the Roman armies. And then what sign do you see in verse 29?
The sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light and the stars will fall from the sky and the powers of heaven will be shaken.
Okay. Now this is reminiscent of what we've already seen in Joel and in Acts. And the important phrase, I think, the summative phrase to this part of this sign is the powers of the heavens will be shaken. It's not that the sun falls from the sky or that the moon falls from the sky. Those were representative of the power that then existed. And as far as the Jews were concerned, this was those people that had been even appointed by God to be power. It's a phrase we've seen this before. Isaiah 13, beginning at about verse 10. This is the judgment on Babylon back then. And he says it this way, the stars of heaven and the constellations thereof shall not give their light. The sun shall be darkened in its going forth. The moon shall not cause its light to shine. This was God saying, I'm going to judge Babylon. And this is what it means. This is the way you would describe it. It was the end of Babylon. So he says he uses the same phraseology, the same images. And remember, these were images that were absolutely familiar to the Jews. It happened in Sodom and Gomorrah. Okay. And then verse 30. That'll be the last one that we discuss tonight.
And they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and with glory.
Okay. So, Jesus had told Caiaphas, high priest, same thing in Matthew 26, or will tell him the same thing in Matthew 26. He said to Caiaphas, who is the high priest, henceforth you shall see the coming of the Son, or shall see the coming. I can read, okay. Henceforth you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven. So Caiaphas gets to see this picture that he's coming on the clouds. This is a picture, well, we didn't look at coming with the clouds. We looked at the day of the Lord. So you just might want to write these passages down. Isaiah 19, verses 1 through 4. This is when God comes in judgment on Egypt. Then look at Jeremiah 4 at verse 13. This time it's not Egypt, it's Judah. So Jesus is coming in the clouds. So then we're going to go on.
Isaiah, what did you say?
Isaiah 19, verses 1 through 4. And my conclusion is the Isaiah reference is talking about Egypt. So then when I see this phrase repeated, that Jesus is going to come in the clouds, at Jesus' ascension up to heaven, I think it's referring in that place to the second coming and the final judgment. But there could be some question about that. So I'm not going to be adamant about that. I think in general, most people that I respect as Bible students have agreed with everything we've said up to this point. We are going to continue and we'll talk about the rest of the prophecy. And we'll talk about further statements that Jesus makes. And this is where there is some question about what the reference is. Some people think that the end of Matthew is talking about the final judgment. Some people think that the end of Matthew is still talking about the judgment against Jerusalem. I tend to think that it's still talking about the judgment against Jerusalem. That can become a bit problematic, and you must be very careful when you think about that in terms of what's called fulfilled eschatology, a notion that the entirety of the Bible and all prophecy, every statement about judgment was fulfilled at Jerusalem, which would indicate that there is no final judgment. So you just have to be careful when you talk about fulfilled eschatology. That's not doesn't tend to be something that's a part of millennial theories, but this notion of fulfilled eschatology was particularly prevalent up in the area around Seattle. That would have been in the late 70s and early 80s. And churches there were really disturbed by this. So we have to be very careful to separate what Jesus says about the destruction of Jerusalem. Jesus also talks about his second coming. But I think this whole passage here in Matthew 24 and Matthew 25, I think the primary reference is to the destruction of Jerusalem. So we'll continue with this, and just something that we need to be sure that we come to an understanding about. And again, I have a view that is a little different than the view that's presented in the two articles that I gave you to read. The reason that I gave you those articles is because I don't express that view as clearly as I think they do. Hopefully I can express my view clearly, but I don't express their view as clearly as they are able to do. So any thoughts before we sign off at this point, take a break?
Yes.